announcements, and they stumbled through Koheleth, because both of the titles have Koheleth rather than Ecclesiastes. You'll know that you're coming back for, if you choose to, for another Bible study on Ecclesiastes. My name is Peter Nash, and it's the 23rd of August. I can't believe it's over. 1991. I need to speak louder?
He has problems.
That's all right, I can pull my chair up.
I can talk louder too. let me begin with, in a traditional way, and say a word about the name and the date of the book. Koheleth is, most of the books of the Old Testament in their Hebrew names begin with, take their names from either the first word or the first significant word in the first line. And Ecclesiastes begins the words of Koheleth, son of David, king in Jerusalem, but nowhere does it say which son of David, and we don't have any record of any king named Koheleth. This is an active participle, and it's feminine singular, so we run into some problems with this book right away. We've got a king, not a queen, who calls himself by this feminine singular noun, noun/verb. Participles, as those of you who remember your grammar, remember that participles are a strange form. The root for this word means to assemble. So it's the assembler, the one who calls into the assembly. And when you read your translations, I think it will say, most of these, you have a Revised Standard, have the preacher. But it's the assembly, the assembler, is where we get this name Ecclesiastes. When it was translated into Greek, ekklesia means the assembled, and Ecclesiastes then became the name of the book. So that's a little bit about the name. That's mostly an enigma. We don't know what it really meant to them, and we certainly don't know why it's a feminine singular participle rather than a masculine singular participle. The date of the book, well, as we'll talk about in just a moment, it comes from a tradition that was quite long and international, but the language of the text as we have it seems to be very late, down about the 3rd, maybe even the 2nd century BCE, before the Christian era.
That's okay.
Before the Common Era, yes. It used to be before Christ, now before the Common Era. Not error, as I slipped out there. The use of a particular relative pronoun that doesn't show up before the 3rd century, quite commonly through the book. The syntax changes, the use of participles in the book, in a way that occurs late in the tradition, the transmission of the language. But there are things in the book that are very old. There are proverbs in this book that have been around for a millennia and a half before the book was written down. So it's an old book and it's a new book, relatively speaking, as the Old Testament goes. Well, on to this question of the wisdom or sapiential tradition. It was an international intellectual tradition. If you look at Proverbs 22, 23, the second half of 22, 23, and 24, and then go back to the Egyptian literature, Egyptian instructions, as they are called, from the wise man to his son, or to the person who was to take over his job, you'll find the very same proverbs in almost the same order from the 15th century BCE and from the 21st century BCE. Very similar proverbs, but the ones from the 15th century are almost identical in content and order to what we have in these 2.5 chapters of Proverbs. Indication is that they shared a wisdom tradition. They shared a tradition of how do we live our lives? What is the best way to live? Also in Mesopotamia, the land between the Tigris and the Euphrates, where the Assyrians and the Babylonians live, their literature also has a strain that is sapiential or wisdom-oriented, not in the proverbial sense, but in disputations, conversations going back and forth between two about which is the better fruit, for example. But how to argue, how to carry on discourse, how to get ahead in the world is one part of the wisdom tradition. And I call that traditional wisdom. If you want a job, how do you do it? If you go to a party, which fork do you use first? Where do you put your napkin? Do you put it on your lap or do you tuck it in under your collar? How do you greet the host? How do you carry on conversation? Do you take seconds? I mean, those sorts of things are actually there in the Proverbs, if not where you put your napkin, but do you take seconds when you go to your boss's house or the rich man's house? That's there.
Is it there?
Yeah, the answer is no. You take what they give you and be satisfied. In the Proverbs. And those are instructions in how to make your way in life. And the assumption is if you do A and B, then C will follow. If you do B and C, then D will follow. That's the traditional wisdom. How do we live well? How do we live rightly? And that's good, and it's a part of the tradition. It's an international tradition which the Israelites then Yahwehized, or more correctly, Elohisticized, the two major names for God in the Hebrew Bible, Yahweh and Elohim. They put a particularly Elohistic face on the Proverbs, and in some cases Yahwehistic. The beginning of wisdom is the fear of the Lord. So that this particular God, not any God, our particular God, so that the Hebrew scribes, the Hebrew sages had their own version of the wisdom that floated around in the international intellectual circuit. Well, that's one kind, how you get ahead. The other kind is the experiential. And there are two, Proverbs is the best example of the first kind, but there are two good examples. Of the experiential wisdom strain in the Hebrew Bible, and they are Job and Kohelet. They look at this, they both look at the traditional wisdom, and they, on the basis of what they've seen in the world, say, yeah, but. Yeah, in most cases, if you follow these rules, things will be fine, but it certainly doesn't always work that way. And if you look at the book of Job, it is nothing but the yeah, but. Right? The structure of Job is prose, prologue, in which we hear at least three times that Job was an upright man, blameless before God. I mean, Job was so good that when his kids had a party, which they did regularly, Job would go out the next morning and offer a sacrifice just in case they happened to have sinned in their hearts. Yeah. That's what Job did on... And so what did Job do for himself? Might be the logical question, but he's extending his goodness beyond himself to his children in a very responsible way. And in the prologue, those first two chapters, we get from the very mouth of God three times, there is none like Job, blameless and upright. So God, God's self, tells us that there's nothing wrong with Job. It's the accuser, which we, that's the translation of Hasatan, Satan, who, by the way, is still not, even at the point of Job, someone equal with God to fight it out with God, but just one of the heavenly beings who happens to be in God's presence to come in and give his, I don't know, quarterly report. What have you been doing? Walking to on the throne. Have you seen my servant Job? There is none like him, blameless and upright, who fears God and shuns evil. So from the very mouth of God, Job is okay. Job hasn't done anything wrong. But Satan is allowed, the accuser is allowed to mess first with his property, then with his family, and then with his very being as the test goes on. Well, once we move out of the prologue, the prose part, and into the older part of the story as we understand it, all that we have is this "yeah, but." Job in chapter 3 says, "Oh, I wish that I'd never been born." He complains. So much for the patience of Job. Complains and whines and wants to be dead. And the friends show up and they're shocked at what they see. They can't believe it because these guys know that Proverbs work. Proverbs works. You know, that kind of question. If you do this, if you do this, if you do this, then you'll be well. And Job had done that all of his life and he had been well. And so he must have sinned. He must have done something. And so they come, "Well, yeah, Job, we're sorry. But you know, if you just confess, then God will forgive you and things will go back to normal." Right? And Job, each one of the three friends, and they all take a shot at, all take two shots, or I guess two of them take two shots and one takes one shot at Job, or one and a half shots at Job. And Job always responds saying, "No, no, I didn't do that. I didn't do this." And in chapter 18, we get this thing that looks a lot like the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments. And the mix in with the Deuteronomic prohibitions. "I never lusted after the virgin or the young woman. I never withheld the laborer his day's wages. I, you know, I'm a good guy. You know, you can't pin this on me." And we also have the prologue, you know, from the very mouth of God saying, "This is a good guy." But all of the traditional wisdom flows out from the friends, and then from another young friend comes in, steps in. And he lays out, again, the traditional wisdom. "In Job, you must confess, and God can't make a mistake. This is the way it has to work." And Job defends himself again. And finally, in chapter 38, God shows up and says, first to the friends, "You don't understand. Job didn't do anything wrong." Then to the young friend, "You really are fouled up, confused young man." It's getting much easier for me to say that about the young man than it was just a few years ago. And to Job himself, "Who are you to ask for an audience with God? Do you think you really understand how the heavens and the earth were created? Do you think you really understand how the creator of the universe thinks and acts?" No, it's a much bigger picture than you can conceive of. So on the small scale, Job's friends, or the Bible, I think, is willing to say, yeah, on the small scale, traditional wisdom works. But on the broad scale, it is experiential wisdom that shows that the wise man and the fool go down at the same place. Sheol. That one is no better than you. Now remember, we're talking, you know, before anybody gets upset, we're talking pre-Christian literature. If you've got a big investment in the afterlife, you shouldn't be looking to the Old Testament, but we didn't give you a choice this week, or this, the last 2 days, did we? But it does change through the intertestamental period and into the New Testament time as to what kind of life we look for, what kind of judgment we look for. And Ecclesiastes, Kohelet, the book that we're going to look at today, is a similar kind of wisdom. Doesn't run us through a story, except in a very, it claims to be sort of the memoirs of a really wise guy. You know, somebody who really knew the answers, who knew as much and had as much as one can have, and found out that doesn't do it either. That your PhD or your EED or whatever is not going to answer all the questions. There's still going to be a lot of exceptions, a lot of things in the broad picture that just don't work. good theory is great, but you got to have experience tacked onto it, or underlying it. I shouldn't say tacked on, experience and data underlying it. And the data will tell you that nothing, you can't put everything into a theory. The proverbs don't work. Now, who is this Koheleth? Again, we don't really know, but the story sets us up as this is the son of David in Jerusalem, and who collected proverbs, who went out to know everything, and who had everything. So who does that look like? Solomon, the really wise guy. Historically speaking, too, Solomon that's traditionally speaking, Solomon with the Proverbs is thought to have collected the Proverbs, both the Proverbs in the Bible as well as many others. We have a couple of stories of just how, showing just how wise he was. The two women who claimed to claim motherhood of the same child, and he has the great way to figure out which one is really invested in this child. The Queen of Sheba, or Saba, we're not sure, there's some confusion about it, comes because she's heard of his wisdom. So in the text, traditionally, he's set up as the wisest of all the wise kings. And historically, the period of Solomon's reign is the wealthiest. And there's more monumental architecture. Not only is the temple built during his period, but the whole nation is fortified up down at Gezer and up at Samaria. There are fortresses built at the extremes of the empire. So it's a very wealthy period. So if there's anybody who should be able to talk about how great the system works in Israelite mind, it should be Solomon, because he is the one guy who had it all from the temporal standpoint. Wisdom. Didn't have any problem, well, I wouldn't put it that way, didn't have any problem getting women at any rate. Riches. I mean, he just had it all. Yes, ma'am?
I have a question about wisdom words. Is sapiental, is that Latin, or does that mean that there is wisdom when it's there?
Yes, yeah, it's just the way you'll see it's referred to sometimes in some of the books. It's from the Latin.
Okay.
Yeah.
What relation does this have to the wisdom that's personified in the Old Testament?
Well, the wisdom that's personified in the Old Testament is in the book of Proverbs, in I think 8 and 9, that is quite interesting. Wisdom is in 8, partner with God at creation. That's where Logos theology, I don't want to go too far afield here, but if you're familiar with Logos theology that comes up in John, I think that's where it comes from, a certain philosophical approach to religion, to faith in Yahweh, whereas wisdom, reason, is God's partner, and we still say that today. I mean, that's why we have professors of Old Testament and theology in our seminaries, because we think that reason is an important part of our faith, but it does come from this tradition. We often talk about the tradition, let's say another word here while I'm at this point, we often talk about the traditions as if they're contradictory or consecutive. That, when Paul Hansen was here last week, he talked about government in Israel, politics, and he talked about about theocracy, and then the monarchy, and then prophetic dialectic, and then sapiential, and then apocalyptic. And in that, if you're talking about forms of government, then they were consecutive. But all through the history of Israel, all of these strains existed, and it's only that for one period or another, one would rise to the top and take precedence. So early, the idea that God is actually the ruler was up top, and that's the way things ran. But there was always a monarchical strain. If you read, for example, the Gideon story, well, his son became the judge. They didn't call him a king, but it's what is it when somebody's the leader and his son becomes the leader? Unless it's a Kennedy. So those are the broad lines of the wisdom tradition. We're going to look at Ecclesiastes as one side of this. And tomorrow, I'll be suggesting that we all should be using, that Ecclesiastes should move closer to the center of the canon. Right now, it's out on the periphery. And when was the last time you heard somebody actually preach on Ecclesiastes or even read it in church? I think there are two passages, two sections that come up. Remember your Creator, and then the wonderful poem that we'll read at the end of the hour today from chapter 3. I think those are the only two pieces from Ecclesiastes that come up in the lectionary. And they're great, but it doesn't give us a chance to see what this wise person had to say to us. And that it, you know, if it's in the canon, I think we should read it. You know, I think we should have it as at least part of our regular reading. I'm not going to suggest that it should be the center of the canon, but it should be closer to the center of the canon. One of the things that I'll be arguing in part today, but with full intention tomorrow, is that Ecclesiastes tells us how to choose a vocation. It's in, and I'll tip it off here. It says fairly late in the book, follow your heart's desire and remember you will answer to God in the end. And it's sort of a double-edged sword for some of us, but that's I think very important. I think that's different from follow your bliss. I've been inundated with Joseph Campbell this week. I like Campbell, but I don't think it's the same thing as what Campbell is saying. I think it's saying, in this community, if you're a person of faith, God has made you to do a particular thing. Go do it. Go do it. But we'll talk about that more fully tomorrow. The things I want to deal with today are, is this guy really cynical? No, he's not really cynical. He's very realistic. And one of the places that he's very realistic is he says, life is short. It's way shorter than we can imagine. And sometimes, some of us, you know, my grandmother died at 96 this March. But her husband died at 55 or 56, 2 months before I was born. And it's this word that in most of your translations is going to be translated as vanity, sometimes meaninglessness. It's a word that means a puff of breath.
That
a puff of breath. That's what life is. And you better recognize that, and while it's moving, do something with it, because it is going to stop. Interestingly enough, they're not the same word, but they use the same consonants. If you read Genesis 4, Abel, his name, the son who was cut off, had a very short life, murdered by his brother, is spelled the same way, at least consonantally. And I think that's significant. I've never seen anything in the scholarly literature about him and this word, but I can't. And remembering that originally the Hebrew text had no vowels, so the words would have looked the same, exactly the same on the page. That they had to be, there had to be at least a circular connection between these two, the one whose life was cut short, and the fact that life is, and that's what it is. Now, for some of us, that sounds very negative, and you still want to say that this guy's a cynic. I say no, he's a realist. The other thing that I want to look at is profit. I think in the RSV it's translated as gain. What gain is there in ABC?
P-R-O-F-I-T.
Yeah, profit with an F, not with a, with the P-H-E. I have this idea of profit as I make something and it costs me $10 to make it, I sell it for $18, and then I have $8 to spend and $10 to go buy the materials to make it again, and then I can make another $8, and sooner or later I have $264 or $1,024 or whatever the multiples of eight are. And that's, I'm afraid that many of us look at this word profit that way. And in its source, it's all right, because what that profit is what's left over after you've paid for your materials. What remains? But that's the question that Kohelet is asking when he says, what gain is there? Is it what remains? It's from this word down here, Y-T-H-R, yether. What is left over? What exceeds the needs, and what can you pile up? And the answer is, not much. You can't pile things up. You can't pile experience up. You can't pile joy up. I'm one of these people that things start going well and I start looking over my shoulder. You know, okay, what's going to happen now? One of my classmates used to tell a joke about his friend, you know, he never knew them, but his friend, the Calvinist, who got to the steps and fell down the steps head over heels, got to the bottom and said, I'm glad that's over with. I'm sort of like that, you know, oh God, the tragedy's over, now we can get on and sort of exist to the next one. Well, Ecclesiastes is trying to, you know, we can't pile up stuff. Of anything of value can't be piled up, can't be stockpiled. You've got to use it while it's there. And that sends us back, he doesn't, but it sends me back to the idea of the manna in the wilderness. You collect it for the day, you use it up, and if you don't use it up at the end of the day, it rots. And there, you get up in the next morning, and there are worms. We can't pile anything worth having, we can't pile it up. We can't save it for later. We've got to use it while we've got it. Yes?
The cynic is the one who anticipates the hurt. Yeah, but I don't see that so much here, as one who just says the hurt will come.
Yeah.
And I think to know that the hurt will come does not necessarily make one cynical.
Yeah. I agree, but when I read the literature, the scholarly literature, and even the interpretive literature for the lay audience about Ecclesiastes, about Kohelet, cynic comes up over and over and over again. And I don't see that here, and that's why I ask the question, is he a cynic or is he a realist, a visionary realist? You can't have if you have a vision that's not based in reality, then you're talking about fantasy.
Part of the difference between cynicism and realism is your attitude about it. Cynicism is there's bitterness in it.
Yeah.
And realism is what is.
Yeah. There's bitterness in it, and there's a sense of, you know, why bother? You know, I'm going to fall down the stairs, so why bother go up? Yeah. So. What I want to do most of the rest of today is to look at a couple of passages that I think will help me support my claim that about what he's talking about when the word vanity or meaninglessness or meaningless comes up here. So this word comes up all over the place in Ecclesiastes, but let's drop down. Oh, first, before we do that, let's read the first chapter of Ecclesiastes, because I'm convinced that in many cases in the Hebrew Bible, if you read the first chapter or the first section, you get a little summary, a little precis as to what's coming in the book. So if someone would read the first 11 verses for me, or for us, please.
The words of the teacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, says the teacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What do people gain from all the toil at which they toil under the sun? A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun goes down, and hurries to the place where it rises. The wind blows to the south and goes around to the north. Round and round goes the wind, and on its circuits the wind returns. All streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, there they continue to flow. All things are wearisome, more than one can express, The eye is not satisfied with seeing, or the ear filled with hearing. What has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done. There is nothing by those who come after them.
Okay. Now, some people look at that and say, oh my God. For some of the things that we talk about up here at Holden, you know, this is, oh my God, this is great. We're not going to ruin the earth. The earth will stand forever, as Eric pointed out to me in the first Bible study. Yeah, the earth may be here, but it may not be able to support us. Pardon?
The earth may be here, but we may not be on it.
Right. But I keep looking for the hope here. So. Things run in a circuit, and they're reliable. The natural things are reliable, and they're without end. And we can't change them.
People talk today about this marvelous new concept of circular thinking rather than linear thinking. This is circular thinking way back before.
Oh yeah, well, you know, linear thinking's quite late. You know, even if you put it with Aristotle and, or Socrates, it still comes late in the scheme of people really thinking. Yeah, but this is an example of and you will see that the book is not a linear book. It doesn't go straight to its argument and stop at its endpoint where it's culminated. It keeps going around and around. And I think that's one of the great things about the book is that it gives us a sense of we're going around with it, and that's okay. You know, that's fine. We have our time in it, and then you know, if you want to think about offspring, whether they be intellectual offspring or physical offspring, we don't get to do everything. We get to do part of it, but we get to do our part. And things move on. In this next section, we saw some of it in the circuitry or circuitousness of the world. But in the next section, I want you to think about the breath images and the tiredness images. I love this picture of all of the waters, all the rivers running to the oceans, and yet the oceans are never full. If you've been someplace where it's rained for days and days and days, and then you realize, you know, we live a few blocks from Lake Michigan. You know, Lake Michigan hardly noticed. My basement may be flooded, but Lake Michigan didn't notice. This here is a picture of their worldview, in this idea about the sun running its circuit. Now they had a flat earth with a big dome over it holding back all that blue stuff that we see up there. That's water waiting to fall down on us in the rain. So the sun would start in the east, run its circuit, be tired out at the end of the day, take a rest, end up, come back to its spot, come around again. So all these pictures of things somewhat, even in that case, you know, with the imagery, somewhat personified, running their circuit, being tired, but continuing to do the same thing. Because that's what the sun does. Is it rises and it shines and it sets. And it's hard work, but it's the sun's work, I think, is the underlying idea here. Would someone read 12 through 18, and again, listen for these breath images, these tired images, being out of breath. Thank you.
I, the preacher, have been king over Israel and Jerusalem, and I applied my mind to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. It is an unhappy business that God has given to the sons of men to be busy with. I have seen everything that is done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and a striving after wind. What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be numbered. I said to myself, I have acquired great wisdom, surpassing all who were over Jerusalem before me, and my mind has had great experience of wisdom and knowledge. And I applied my mind to know wisdom, and to know madness and folly. I perceive that this also is but a striving after wind. For in much wisdom is much vexation, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow.
Sounds like you did a PhD. Or at least went to college. We all get our vexation in different points, I guess. Any comments about what we've heard and seen so far? Yes.
Is this the same ruach, the wind of God? And does this reflect a little bit the whole medieval idea of the Deus of Scandicus, or is it not the God of the wind?
Well, I don't. It is here. It is ruach. The common word for wind and spirit in the Hebrew Bible, Ruach Elohim Rachefet, the spirit or the wind of God hovered over the void, the waters, in the early creation story, the first creation story. Which in some part of the tradition is, well, certainly in the Christian tradition, is one of the manifestations of God, one of the way God makes God's self known to us, Father, Son, and Spirit. And in the Hebrew, in some parts of the Hebrew Bible, cannot be separated from God. Other parts, it can be separated from God. I hadn't thought about that, of the hidden God, the God who hides from us. I hadn't thought about Ecclesiastes making God happiness. It's not. It's out of this sapiential tradition, and so it's not quite as theistic as some of the other books. But it's an interesting question. I would be. I'm sure that if I were to look at the medieval writers, we would find them looking at Ecclesiastes and in some of those arguments of the hidden God, the Deus absconditus, is that. The old phrase for the God who's always present, but we have to look to find him. It's always, God is always someplace we can't see. He doesn't show up on the road. We ask the question, why doesn't God show up on the road like he did for Joshua? tell him what to do. Why doesn't God do that for us? And it's because God, this idea of a God who is hidden.
What is made of the image of wind?
What is made here of the image of wind?
God, it could be life, because from Hebrew, air was the source of life.
Yeah, I think this is wind, period, and that trying to pile this stuff up is trying to go out and grab the wind, you know? Unless you've got a kite or a sail, you can't do anything, or a windmill, you can't do anything with the wind,
and they went. If it doesn't blow, it doesn't do any good.
Yeah, right. He said, if it doesn't blow, it doesn't do you any good. Even if you do have a sail or a kite or a windmill. But I think it's the picture of if you're trying to save this important stuff that comes to us at different points in life, or contrarywise, to avoid it on the things that we count as negatives. You're wasting your time. It's like trying to avoid the wind on the negative side, or trying to contain the wind for the positive things.
I don't understand why. It says that God has given human beings this unhappy business. I don't understand why God has given us this unhappy thing to do, which is in reference to chasing the wind, trying to get things that you cannot get.
Yeah.
It sounds like that's our lot in life. That's what you gotta do, chase after things you're never gonna get.
Well, I think it's a matter of how human beings are constructed, or how human beings construct themselves to try to do things that are like chasing the wind. I don't think again, one of the teachers last week talked about how he was in Bible studies, about how he loved to go to work in the morning. And I said, yeah, but you're doing exactly what you decided you wanted to do. And if you're doing that, then it's not a problem. But if you're doing what your dad told you you should be doing, or you're doing something simply to put food on the table, which a lot of people do, rather than doing something that you find meaningful, then that's when work becomes this evil, this hard business that God's given us. If we think that we are going to, that we as human beings are going to make an ultimate difference, are going to make our mark on the whole world, that is chasing the wind. I think is what the point is here.
I guess the contradiction for me is that everything God made is good. God made everything.
Mm-hmm.
Not everything is good. There is misery in the world. God made misery.
Or we make it. But, you know, the Job story would certainly support that. That it's under God's control and God can at any moment wipe it away, but it doesn't. But another side of it is that human beings are made with the capacity for both good and evil. And we fill the world up with as much evil as we do good. That God made everything and everything is good, I think, is absolutely true. However, golf, to me, any golfers here?
It's misery. It's like chasing the wind.
Exactly. And the way I hit the ball, it is chasing the wind. I don't know where it is. So golf is fun for you two, right? It's meaningful interaction with friends and exercise. For me, golf, it would be chasing the wind. If I had a job where I had to play golf in order to make contacts, The job would be miserable for me. For me, basketball or bike riding. That's another way of exercising. That's another part of the world that for me is really exciting, really interactive. But I don't expect anybody else. I don't want to say to somebody, you have to come play basketball. Boy, basketball is the only sport. I actually wrote an essay like that my freshman year in freshman college. Why basketball was the queen of all sports, so to speak.
I guess, I understand this is part of religious literature, but I don't hear so much of the good and evil and the God in here. It seems to me this is a very honest statement of the experience of what life feels like to people who really think seriously about it. And even if you have something that you have a great deal of joy in, if you push at the edges of it to say, what meaning does it have, you can pretty quickly unravel
how
valuable that is.
And I think this book would say, don't push at the edges. Sort of like Zorba. If you're happy, be happy.
But I think that's kind of, Scott Peck, I can't remember which book, talks about the, I'm interpreting, so I may be putting things in there, but the spirit person, the mature person is probably his language, as someone who has great riches and great sadness, because they see both sides of life. To be alive is to have these experiences.
Yeah.
You can deny them. You don't need to unravel them. But it's a much more being kind of thing than doing. If you think you're going to get out of it by doing something, it ain't going to work that way.
Yeah.
All that there is the experience to have.
Right. But back off. I want to back off a little bit of all that there is. There's a lot, and we're gonna end in about 5 minutes now with the great poem from this book, because life is so full. In my field, Walter Brueggemann, Brueggemann, has written a book that I think is in the bookstore called Message of the Psalms, where he talks very similarly about the use of the Psalms, and he talks about the Psalms in three categories, which are not the traditional categories of the academic study of the Psalms. One is Psalms of orientation, and this is not what he says, but this is the way I talk about them to my class. This is the person who had a life like mine up until about age 30, where everything has gone well. Things are great. And you know that there's a God, and God takes care of you, and that's wonderful. And then there's some sort of tragedy or disaster, or basically facing the reality of that there are some ugly things in this world, and you get caught in one of them. Then there, the second category is songs or psalms of disorientation, where the whole world is upside down, and you don't know where God is. And these are basically the psalms of lament, to use the traditional category. Where are you, God? Rescue me from my distress. And then there are the psalms of reorientation. Once you've been through this and managed to get the world right side up again, and realize, be able to know where God is and know that God is in more places than you could have imagined in the earlier stage, and not in some of the places you assumed God to be in the earlier stage, then you're in the stage of reorientation. Those are songs that are much more mature and full, that acknowledge the fullness of life, both with its good and with its bad. I'm gonna run quickly here. If someone would read Ecclesiastes 2:18 and 19 for me.
I hated all my toil in which I had toiled under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to the man who will come after me. And who knows whether he will be a wise man or a fool? Yet he will be master of all for which I've toiled and used my wisdom under the sun. This also is vanity.
Yeah. All right. So this is the guy who went out to know everything. He owned everything. He understood everything as well as he was a really bright guy. Taught maybe even at the University of Chicago. I guess where I went to school. Wealth, and he says, and when I die, and I know I will, I don't know who's going to get it. And he might be a smart guy like me, or he might be a fool. I have no control over it, and I don't know how he will use it. And we happen to know that Solomon's son, the traditional author of this book, was Rehoboam, who wasn't so smart, and the kingdom was rent through a bad decision that he made, or a series of bad decisions. And that was actually the outcome, that it went to a fool, and out it went. And so the piling up of all this wisdom, of knowing everything, is vanity. I can't store it, I can't save it, I can't keep it. It's for me or it's for nothing. It's for now or it's for nothing, because if I think I'm going to make the ultimate difference, there it goes. Let's look at Psalm 39, 5 and 11. We'll look at 4 and 5 and 11.
Psalm 39, 4 and 5.
Yes, please.
Lord, let me know my end, and what is the measure of my days? Let me know how fleeting my life is. Behold, thou hast made my days a few handbreadths, and my lifetime is as nothing in thy sight. Surely every man stands as a mere breath.
Okay, a mere breath. And that word there is hevel. Every man is a, every human is a, that's what human existence. A few hand breaths, that's all we are in the grand scheme of things. And that my life is as nothing is not a matter of God doesn't care for you. It's a matter of you're here this long. And God is aware of that, but in the grand scheme of God, from Alpha to Omega, that's what it is. Right? And did you read 11? Would you read 11?
No. When thou dost chasten man with rebukes for sin, thou dost consume like a moth what is dear to him. Surely every man is a mere breath.
Okay, every human being is a... Right. That's how much time we have. Gosh, we better use it. And in that time, a lot of stuff is going to get packed in. Let's look at Ecclesiastes 3, and we'll end today with that. For everything there is a season or an appointed time, and a time for every matter under heaven, a time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to pluck up what is planted, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to break down and a time to build up, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance, a time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones together, a time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing, a time to seek and a time to lose, a time to keep and a time to cast away, a time to tear or rend and a time to sow, a time to keep silence and a time to speak, a time to talk to love and a time to hate, a time for war and a time for peace. What gain, what excess, what gather upable kind of stuff is there, has the worker from his toil, from his work. All of these things are part of human existence. It's not a prescription, go to war. Not a prescription, never go to war. I'm saying in human existence, these things are all contained in this a few hand breaths. And you can either receive them and live through them, or you can try to avoid them or try to store up the good parts of them. But if you do that, you're just fooling yourself and you're going to miss most of your life. Yes?
There are stories about monks who sleep in their coffins as a remembrance of death in order to promote humility and to live as fully as possible in this life.
Yeah, that each day, you know, well, it's a new day to do something. You know, people who start their day with, this is the day that the Lord has made, song, let us rejoice and be glad in it. You know, hey, this is, we don't know. It may be the last one. It may, you know, it may be 11 o'clock. It may be over for one of us. So let's use the next hour. And then the next hour. And the next hour, doing what we think is really important. Now I'm into tomorrow. So thank you for your attention. And hope I see you tomorrow.
Thank you. Okay.